Welcome to Full Prefrontal, the show that exposes the mysteries of executive function. This podcast is a collection of conversations about the role of the prefrontal cortex, which impacts your focus, planning, problem solving, emotional balance, and independence. So join us as we explore executive function and the science of learning. And now, here's your host, the founder of EXQ, Sucheta Kamath.
Welcome to another episode of Full Prefrontal. My mission is to help people understand that their brain's prefrontal cortex is wired to be the CEO of the brain, ready to act as the chief executive officer, performing all the C-suite duties, pursuing higher goals, tracking and securing the future interest of self, taking critical decisions, and vetoing undesirable action, however pleasurable they might be. And at its best, this central executive acts as the air traffic controller, repurposing tools, directing actions, calibrating emotions, tweaking behaviors and decisions in order to create a beautiful and harmonious symphony that leads to inner well-being as well as outer success. And my highly talented guest unveiled the key features of the system that drive and propel it into the self-regulated machine. Their unique perspectives and expertise help promote the growth and development of this prefrontal cortex so that we can collaborate, communicate, and connect. So it's a great pleasure to invite a very, very special guest. I have many connections to this guest. One particular connection my guest is aware of. The rest, he's not. So it's my great honor to have Dr. Tal Ben-Shahar, who is an author and a lecturer. He taught two of the largest classes at Harvard University's history, positive psychology, and the psychology of leadership. Today, Tal consults and lectures around the world to executives in multinational corporations, the general public, and at-risk population. The topics of his lectures include leadership, happiness, education, innovation, ethics, self-esteem, resilience, goal setting, and mindfulness. He has multiple books, prolific writer, and two particular books that I'm interested in kind of getting his insights on. One is The Pursuit of Perfect, which is amazing, and The Happier. So Learn the Secrets of Daily Joy and Lasting Fulfillment. And the personal connection is he has blessed my young college student, my son Rahil, by teaching him a course in psychology, which has led to incredible conversations. And I remember the discussion we had when he first got on the waitlist to be able to take part. So we'll talk about that in a second. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you for being here with me today.
Thank you, Sucheta, and it's great to be here. And I must say, it was so great to get to know your son, Rahil, over the semester. And just behind the scenes for the listeners, we have a deal here. I'm going to do this podcast, but I asked for parenting tips. So,
oh my goodness, I'm flattered and honored, and I will take it with a grain of salt and not hog all the credit. Some children are just born with great temperament, and they make parents look good. So I'll leave it at that. But I will tell you a few things. That one is, he just, in every juncture of your life, you have certain charismatic adults who have incredible influence. And I think his decision to go into psychology and you being in his life has collided in such a beautiful way that he is inspired by your teaching style, which is, he says, and I have quotes, he says, you introduce large topics, but you get into a simple steps that lead to understanding the large topics, which really made it an extremely personable experience. You are so knowledgeable, which I told him the word, you are a polymath. Rahil is just a chemath. So I told him, you need to become a polymath. And finally, he said, it's so funny. He says, me and my girlfriend and I, we practice this mutual appreciation with a loved one exercise that you taught him. And so I kind of sent him frowny faces. I said, and what about Bob here? Why are you not doing that with your mom every day? But anyways, it's really so fantastic to have an influential educator, and none better than you. So I want to get started with you. And since the topic is executive function, which entails self-awareness, and then using that knowledge to guide oneself through the journey of life, I'm very curious about my guests and experts like you. When do you think you began to notice this flashlight facing inwards and the kind of information you gathered about yourself, and how were you able to influence your own learning and thinking as a young person?
Yeah, you know, obviously we have, as individuals, different tendencies. And many people who end up going into psychology usually lead examined lives. Socrates once wrote, "The unexamined life is not worth living."
Yes.
And I will add to that, that the over-examined life is often tedious. And
I
sometimes erred on the over-examined life. So I'm not just saying this as, you know, as a compliment or as a good thing. You know, there can be too much of a good thing. But I remember specifically one experience where I realized that, I was, captain of the ship, master of my destiny. And it happened when I was 14. And what very much defined my childhood was sports, athletics. I was a squash player. Later on, played professional squash.
And a champion at best.
But way before then, when I was 14, I really wanted to be a top player, and I played competition, age groups, and so on. And then I went to a championship. It was an international championship. And there I saw some of the best players in the world. And it was my first or second time seeing top squash other than, on TV or video. And I was sitting there, and suddenly it dawned on me, and I looked at these players who were a lot better than I was. And I said, I know how to get there. I know what I need to do in order to become that player 5 years, 10 years from now. And in fact, it seemed to me very simple. I said, all I have to do is, I obviously have to have coaching to be coached. But I have to spend, 3, 4, 5 hours a day on court, hitting the ball up and down, and then I will make it. And I thought to myself, wow, it's easy. Now, not easy physically. I knew that it would be very hard and, working in the gym and running and playing, physically hard. But easy in terms of the blueprint and the path
wow.
to success. And that aha moment stayed with me ever since. Even just before, coming to this, to speak with you, my eldest son, who's 16, and he said to me, oh, Dad, I have so much work today. I have math homework and, film class homework, and I have a presentation, and he's preparing for his SATs.
Oh, God.
What am I going to do? And I said, David, it's just work. That's all it is. And just do it one by one by one. And you'll see that at the end of the day, you'll have so many check marks, you'll feel good about yourself. And I mean it. All it is work. Later on, I was exposed to work by Anders
Ericsson.
Ericsson, sorry, Anders Ericsson, who talks about the path to success, the 10,000 hours. But I think that for me was a definitive moment because till today. Okay. So I want to write a book. All it is, putting in the hours, I want to study a new field. All it is, getting to those books and reading them. It's only work.
Wow. That's first of all, I think to me, that's a incredible insight, but secondly, it's a perspective. You had even though you're at the bottom of the hill, it just sounds to me that you had that aerial perspective on the landscape of learning. That's quite young wisdom. I really appreciate that. It's funny you say that. I had this kind of understanding. I was, believe it or not, aspiring artist, but not a single original idea. I was very good at art, producing art. So drawing, painting, all kinds of mediums. And so I came from a very, very tiny place in India. And exposure to entire high school class was 30 kids. So people come from 1400, you know, kids in high school, and I came for 30. So it's not a great perspective. But when I was in seventh grade, I got selected to be in the special class where because I was talented. And at that time, I realized that there are some kids who are naturally able to imagine things without having to see them. That was not something part of my repertoire. If I could see it and I could capture it, copy it beautifully, paint it. And then I saw people completely out of imagination. That perspective gave me an insight that I am not that. Mm-hmm. And every juncture of my life, a lot of things have reminded what I'm not, which has helped me a lot more than what I am.
So I think finding the, you know, the combination or a balance between the two, you know, what am I not?
Yes.
No less important is what am I or who am I? Just like we need to know, you know, what don't I want to do? And what do I want to do? And both perspectives are important.
So true. And so let's talk about one topic I think that's so relevant for these times. And I have had Ander Erickson on my podcast, and I have a great friendship with him. I get to talk with him every now and then. And I've had another researcher, Sunia Luther, who talks about, you're familiar with her work. And what's so fascinating is the amount of pressure there is on the kids, but also pressure in society in general, education and teachers and parents as a culture we have put on becoming something which can then be measured as your achievement. And so I want to kind of talk about being a perfectionist and this tendency. So can you set the stage for us? Where does this desire to be perfect come from, for starters?
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, very often we inherit the desire to be perfect. Karen Horney, who's was a student of Freud and later broke away from Freud back in the 1930s, talked about perfectionism as a neurosis, yes. A neurosis with a genetic foundation, or at the very least a predisposition, of course. So we have an inclination, and then on top of that inclination, we have reinforcement. And the reinforcement comes from our culture. I mean, what do we see in our culture? We see perfect role models. What we see, whether it's the cover of magazines, you know, I had quite a few students, mostly women, who did the research on the impact of the covers of those magazines on women's self-esteem, on their desire to be perfect. And, you know, more and more men actually are struggling with body issues because they're not perfect either. Or we have movies. What do we get in the movies? We get perfectly looking and perfectly living role models, having perfect relationships. And then to top it all off, we have social media. And social media, we see normal people, allegedly, you know, not movie stars, who lead perfect lives. And this...
Or we are choosing to only post those moments that may depict having a perfect moment.
Because I don't want to be the only one who's imperfect, yes. Who has flaws. So I contribute to this great deception, which is very much responsible for the great depression that we are experiencing as a culture. So everything around us conspires towards, you know, this unrealistic perfection. You know, one of the things that I often emphasize when thinking about my parenting, but also when speaking to others about parenting, is the work of Donald Winnicott. And Winnicott, his most famous work is on what he called the good enough mother.
Yes.
Not the perfect mother, the good enough mother. And of course, you know, he wrote in the 50s, 60s, so it was the mother. But today, you know, many fathers are, of course, involved in child rearing. And the good enough parent is a very important concept because children do not need
a perfect
role model. They need someone who's fallible, someone who struggles, someone who learns from failures and from hardships. This is the kind of role model that they need so that they don't fall into the trap of trying to, wanting to be perfect.
You know, I love that. I think the Julius Siegel's concept of the charismatic adult, which is one from whom children gather strength from. And to frame it the way you said it, that we don't gather strength from perfect people. We, in fact, gather strength from those who have unconditional acceptance of the way we are, wherever we are. They meet us where we are.
Of the way we are and the way they are.
Yes.
It's less important, you know, to be the change, you know, in Gandhi's words. We need, so, you know, we're going through, you know, a pandemic now. It's, you know, a very rough ride for most people. And very often during this ride, I've said to my kids, you know, I need a night off, or I'm really feeling down, or can I talk to you about something that I went through at work? And because it's important for me that they have a real model, not to say, oh, my dad's a happiness professor, so I should be happy all the time. But rather to see that, you know, I struggle too, and therefore giving them the permission to struggle as well.
Well, I feel you have left such a trail of breadcrumbs for them, because every book that you have written, you are so honest and candid. And even in this book, Perfect, I think you talk about your own vulnerabilities as a perfectionist striving to tame down the beast. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your story about squash and the kind of messaging you got about excellence translates into perfect all the time?
Yeah. So, you know, throughout my squash career, I had a constant knot in my stomach, and it was always there. And well, the only times when it went away, but it only for a short while, was after I had a perfect practice session, or after winning a tournament and feeling the relief of it all. And I won the Israeli national championships. I'm originally from Israel, which was my dream come true. And I thought, okay, now the knot is going to go away, finally. And it did go away for about 4 hours. And then back again. And then I said to myself, okay, now I have to be the world champion. Then it will go away. And, you know, and I went over to London and played professional squash. And I played with John Shere Khan, who was the world champion at the time. You know, got better and better, but my perfectionism was always my real nemesis. It wasn't the people on court, it was my internal perfectionism. In what way? One way was that I could not embrace imperfection, meaning every practice session had to be perfect. If John Shere Khan, the world champion, trained in a certain way, I had to train in the same way. And of course, what that led to was not just unhappiness and psychological disease, but also physical injuries. So I got injured, and eventually it was my perfectionism that ended my career, my professional career. And you know, I did learn a lot from that experience, but not immediately, because then my perfectionism from squash went to academics.
Yeah, you're right about that. That's amazing.
I had to go and get into, you know, the top university and be, you know, get straight A's, and every deviation from the straight and narrow was immediately punished psychologically. At Harvard, I experienced the same thing that I experienced playing squash, a constant knot in my stomach. So, yes, I felt a relief when I got in, but then in no time that returned. And suddenly I realized that I was you know, the psychological reincarnation of Sisyphus, pushing a rock up the mountain, and then the rock being pushed back down. And then as I studied this is why I actually changed my majors from computer science to psychology and philosophy. As the more I studied, the more I realized I'm not the only Sisyphus. There are millions, maybe billions of us around the world, you know, pushing this rock up and then it being pushed back down. And I started to study it, and more importantly, started to learn from what some very very wise men and women had to say about the topic.
Well, I think I'm going to give you a quote that you write about. But before I do that, I was thinking about that. Ultimately, what I glean from is all life management is pain management. Mm. And if we understand, you write that perfectionists reject failure, reject painful emotions, they reject success, and they reject reality. I mean, wow. And if they're in that mode, then they're certainly not going to be available for being a personal confidant, like somebody who can you gather strength from or propel yourself to do more, because whatever you do, it's never going to be enough. So to juxtapose this concept of perfectionism, you introduce this concept of optimalist. And you write that optimalist accepts reality. They accept that in the real world, some failures and sorrow is inevitable, that success has to be measured against standards that are actually attainable. I love this definition. So talk to us, who is an optimalist, and can that be somebody you raise or raise yourself to be?
Right. So first of all, it's important to understand that optimalism and perfectionism are on a continuum. So there's no one who's a perfect perfectionist. There's no one who's a perfect optimalist. And we, you know, we meander, we move along this continuum. And the challenge is, how can we come closer and closer toward the optimalist end of that continuum? Hmm. Now, what defines that optimalist? You see, the opposite of a perfectionist is not a slacker. So perfectionism, as broadly understood, also has some upsides, because if I mean by being a perfectionist that I'm responsible, yes, and that I'm a hard worker and that I do set high standards, then there's nothing wrong with that. In yes. fact, you know, as people say very often in work interviews, so what is your weakness, they're asked, and they say, oh, I'm a perfectionist. And of course, they don't mean that as a weakness, but rather they say, you can trust me, hire me.
Get it done.
Yeah, exactly. I'll get things done. I'm responsible.
Yes.
So this is the upside, the upside of perfectionism. And it's also one of the reasons why people struggle to get rid of the unhealthy perfectionism, because their subconscious is telling them, I want to remain a perfectionist. Everything that I've achieved in life, or most of it, is thanks to that. So it's important to distinguish what psychologists call maladaptive perfectionism versus adaptive perfectionism. I've called it optimalism, but it's essentially a similar archetype. Now, the optimalist cares about success. They work hard, they are responsible, and they also accept reality for what it is. This is in a nutshell, accept reality for what it is. What does that mean? Part of reality is that we fail. Part of reality is that in order to succeed, to fulfill our potential for success, failure is essential. You know, one of the mantras that I repeat over and over again, and, you know, and I'm sure Rahil in our class, you know, could tear out his hair the amount of times that I say it, is learn to fail or fail to learn.
Yes, he has mentioned that.
Because there is no other way to succeed. Another mantra that I repeat over and over again and again to my students, to myself, to my kids, and to my, you know, C-suite clients. I repeat, giving yourself the permission to be human. In other words, accepting, embracing the full range of human emotions, because that's reality. If my hope is to be happy all the time, not to experience sadness or anger or envy or frustration, that's unrealistic. I'm bound to be disappointed. The optimalist accepts, embraces reality, accepts and embraces failure, accepts and embraces painful emotions, and finally accepts and embraces success. You know, I worked for 5 years. My dream was winning the Israeli national championship. That's what I would literally dream about at night, taking this trophy and lifting it. And I won. And the joy lasted for 4 hours. That's awful. You know, instead of appreciating it, appreciating myself, you know, patting myself on the back. Wow, you worked hard. Nothing. He lays it for 4 hours and then back to the knot in the stomach. You know, that's unhealthy. You know, so when people talk about perfectionism and they say, you know, it's actually not that bad. I'm not talking about the good side of perfectionism. I'm talking about the perfectionism that doesn't allow us to live life fully. Another manifestation of it is in relationships. You know, perfectionists can't take deviation from the straight and narrow. In other words, whenever they are criticized, ever so slightly, it's an attack on their sense of self. And what's the best form of defense? They attack back. and they put up walls and barriers, and it hurts relationships. It hurts in terms of our potential for success. It hurts our happiness levels.
You know, so many thoughts come to my mind. I listened to a leadership podcast by Peter Bregman, and there are a lot of leaders who I'm sure you're familiar with his work too. And then your podcast on Happiness Institute, that I think this idea that you have to be cutthroat or you have to be mean and obnoxious if you're telling the truth is a kind of an adaptive lifestyle. But I have been thinking a lot about that, that it comes from that a perfectionist who has managed to achieve an epitome of his or her own success. Then they look at other people who are failing to do so as if they're failing life. And that's, again, comes to that very rigid thinking about experiences of life. And the second thing that came to my mind about the thing you were saying about that trophy you held and the happiness lasted for 4 minutes. A lot of researchers, 4 hours, which is huge compared to the one that I was about to share with you, was I think what they did, I think you're familiar with this, the experiment where they looked at two groups of people, one who had, they lost the mobility of their left one side because of either, I think, accident or a stroke, and then group that won lottery. And they returned to baseline temperament. It didn't matter what their high was, how high the high took them, or how low the low took them. That has been very telling to me that how it's important for us to really kind of be pragmatic about it. And what I love about your work in this optimist versus pessimist is not many people, when they talk about designing, or particularly in the space of executive function, they don't talk about reality. I think, for example, if you have, and in my work, when I work with people with disabilities, children or adults, and if you do have math disability, that is your reality. So kind of tutoring yourself until the end of time may not be the goal. The goal may be to lean into your disability and say, looks like some careers that involve heavy math may not be for me, but I can be still a full person. You know, that sometimes gets lost on people, which is kind of a shame.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the key topics within the field of positive psychology or the science of happiness is strengths. And there's a lovely quote by Peter Drucker, who spoke to the, I think it was the North American Disabilities Association. And he said the following. He says, it's not disabilities, but abilities that matter. And later on, he says, manage your weaknesses while focusing on your strength.
I love that.
That's about recognizing reality. So, you know, I'm 5'7". Probably never going to reach the NBA, certainly not at the age of 50, even though I would have loved to. So accept that. And then ask, okay, so what are my strengths? Well, my strengths lie perhaps, you know, in writing or public speaking or whatever it is, and then focus on that. What are my passions? You know, it's learning, it's teaching. Focus on that. Now, does that mean that I ignore my weaknesses and my disabilities? Of course not. We need to take them into consideration because they're part of reality. And then once I have the gestalt, the reality, then I choose, where do I want to put my effort? Do I want to put my effort on, you know, 5 hours a day of basketball or 5 hours a day of reading and writing?
That's perfect. So what do you think about the concept of satisficing? You know, the research talks about, which is the just, I guess the idea is that whatever results, or it's a type of decision-making process, I guess, that strives to reach adequate rather than perfect outcomes. Is that something similar to the optimalist, or is becoming an optimalist leads to satisficing stage?
Yeah, so the way I see it is that satisficing is being an optimalist without the excellence. So satisficing can certainly contribute to psychological well-being. However, it is not the prescription for attaining success. success in the conventional sense of the word, that is, of, you know, achieving, you know, achieving your goals, pursuing your dreams. Now, how are they connected? And they're connected in a very important way. You know, some people ask me, so, okay, you've been in this field for 30 years. You know, that's when I started studying psychology. What has changed in your mind? What do you see as different today than you saw when you were in your, you know, early 20s? And the main thing has to do with satisficing. Specifically, it's about expectations. So when I was younger, I thought that having high expectations, great expectations, was the way to go.
Oh, I see.
In every area of life. Why? Because I knew also, you know, the studies on high expectations from children, the Pygmalion effect. I know about hope theory. I know about self-efficacy, Bandura. You know, there's so much research showing if you have high expectations, you'll be successful. And I applied this also to the realm of happiness, not just success.
I see.
That's a problem. Because if my expectation is...
So what's the distinction? So are we, you can be successful and not happy? Is that what you're talking about? Or you can be happy but not successful?
Most successful people in the world are not happy.
So yes, that's true. We know that.
In fact, they're orthogonal, meaning there is no connection.
I see. Gotcha.
For most people between success and happiness. So why do we need to make this distinction? Because if my expectation is that I will live happily ever after, I'll always be happy, that if I study the science of happiness and become an expert in it, then I'll be happy all the time, I'm bound to be disappointed, frustrated, unhappy. In fact, the foundation of happiness is allowing in unhappiness, accepting the fact that life is about ups and downs, and it's natural part of being alive. I'll give you another example. If I go into a relationship and, you know, we're standing at the altar or, you know, reading our vows, and my expectation there is, yes, we'll live happily ever after, just like they do in the movies.
And which we never see.
You know, constant high, constant passion, lust and love. I'm bound to be disappointed because in every relationship, even the best relationships, there are conflicts and disagreements and disappointment and frustration and anger. These expectations, these very high expectations, are unrealistic and therefore lead to unhappiness. So making this distinction between expectations when it comes to success, when having high expectations, is important, whether it's, you know, winning a tournament or getting into a school. That's fine, having these high expectations. When it comes to happiness, our expectations need to be different. They need to be much more tied to reality. Now, how are they connected? To also understand that even if I don't get into my top choice school or my book doesn't do as well as I hoped or I don't win this tournament, so what? That too shall pass. The example that you gave, you know, with people who... who get hurt, who have disabilities, and people who win the lotteries. Yes, winning the lottery leads to a high. We very quickly go back to base level. Yes, being paralyzed in an accident certainly leads to a low. We relatively quickly bounce back.
You know, so I think, so we talked about this. First of all, I love this idea that so begin with expectations. You set the expectations straight, connected to reality. Then the second component is relationship to the failures in your life. And that also sounds like one primary step is accept or welcome or anticipate failures. Do not think, because to me, true learning will not happen if there is no failure. That means if there's no failure, that means you did not need to learn. Rather, I don't know if that was challenged you to learn something new. Mm-hmm. But you talk a lot more in depth about failures. What do people get wrong about failure? Why are people so afraid to fail? Almost they want to inoculate themselves from failure so they safeguard their own experiences and those that they are responsible for, which is so silly to me. Like, failure is so amazing.
Yes. So when I talk about perfectionism, and specifically about the fear of failure element of perfectionism, I always begin the class by saying, okay, full disclosure, here are my objectives. My objectives for this class are two. The first one is that you fail more, because I don't think you fail enough. Second, that you learn to embrace failure rather than to reject it. Now, when I talk about embracing failure, I don't mean, you know, enjoying it. I don't mean saying, oh, I'm so glad I failed, but rather recognize its value, appreciate its value in your life, because there is no other way to learn. The most successful people throughout history, and this is based on research by Dean Simonton from UC Davis and many others, the most successful people throughout history have also been the ones who have failed the most. And you see this among artists, you see this among scientists, you see this among leaders in organizations. Failure and learning from failure translates into long-term success. Not just long-term success, it also translates into resilience, psychological strength.
So, go ahead.
So think about this this analogy. You know, okay, so failure hurts, clearly. However, imagine if you go to the gym and you put such light weights that are so easy to lift. Why? Because you don't want it to hurt. You're not going to get stronger. You're not going to get healthier, better off. You need resistance. Such experiences, difficult experiences, failures, hardship, these are the resistance, the weights that life offers us. And it offers us, and we can potentially grow from them.
So do you see an intersectionality between optimalism and growth mindset, and optimalism and grit? Where do they intersect?
Yeah. So first of all, in terms of the growth mindset, you know, that is, there are so many parallels between the growth mindset and the optimalist and the fixed mindset and the perfectionist. So it's absolutely one of the pillars of the archetype. And when we think about raising children, you know, drawing on the work of Carol Dweck is perhaps the most important thing that we can do in our classrooms for educating optimalists. And in terms of, you know, in terms of grit, you know, you're talking about passion, you're talking about perseverance. These are very much the outcomes of being an optimalist. Because, you know, in one way, squash was my passion. You know, it was very important for me, but it was very important for me not because I loved playing as much as because I wanted to prove myself.
Prove in what sense?
Prove myself in terms of...
I'm capable or I'm better than?
So both. But it was mostly prove myself to the world. You know, why? Why? Because I felt that my value was directly related to my success. So, you know, I just had a flashbulb memory now. I remember after losing a tournament, I was 17. It was a tournament that I should have won. And
you remember, should have is a sign of a perfectionist. No, I'm just kidding.
No, I end my book by saying, my name is Tal and I'm a perfectionist. You know? A perfectionist, always a perfectionist.
Just accidentally successful.
So I remember getting out of this, you know, tournament. And when I say shoot, I was ranked number one. I lost to the number two seed in the final. Coming out and being sure that my girlfriend was going to leave me, and the only reason if she doesn't leave me because she feels sorry for me. So, you know, to that point, that my self-worth. And again, this is very common among perfectionists, is associated with perfect outcome in a tournament, on an exam, at work, financially, whatever it is that you assign importance to as a perfectionist.
So I'm going to ask you a little bit of a heady question. And so I'm an ardent student of Vedanta and talk about self-actualization and to transcend our lower level motivations and pursue higher level motivations, which is greater good, to see something larger than self, which is what you're talking about. And you're encouraging all of us to think about that. So obviously, perfectionism can be a huge barrier in transcending. And I think one of the conversations I was having with some friends, and one of the fears that they were having, forget transcending, but they were talking about that they don't want to lower the standard. They don't want to be that unaccountable. I can be anybody. I don't want to be a hobo. So kind of, if you're not focused, goal-oriented, achieving, opposite of that is incredible, like slacker, useless, nobody. But to me, transcend is to recognize we all are going to me, like when I envision a mountain, I don't see a peak where only one person can stand at a time. So you have to knock him off so that you can take the place. It's like a plateau. Many people can stand together. How do we, like, what's the collective psyche of bringing happiness where you become this person which invites other people to do the same?
Yeah, you know, that's a very important distinction that you made. In our culture, there is a very clear and unambiguous distinction between selfishness and selflessness. So if you go on a, you know, you open a thesaurus and you look for synonyms for selfish, you will find words like self-interest, immoral, evil, inconsiderate, bad. This is what's associated with selfishness. Oh, wow. Then you go on selflessness and you look for synonyms or a definition of selflessness, you know, good, moral, generous, kind. So we all don't like what we read about selfishness, and we certainly like what we read about selflessness. This distinction is unhelpful. In fact, it's destructive. Here is why. You see, when I pursue happiness, it is a selfish pursuit because I'm thinking about my own happiness. And as I, you know, climb up and become happier and happier over the years, I'm helping myself. So that's selfish.
I see.
And I'm also helping others because there is a lot of research showing that when I increase my levels of happiness, I do become more generous and benevolent towards others. When I'm happy, when I feel good about myself, I'm more likely to give and to be kind. So selfishness leads to contribution to others. So is it really selfish? Well, it's certainly not selfish in the sense of being evil and bad and inconsiderate. We have it wrong. Now, on the other hand, when I give, when I help others, when I'm kind toward others, that's nice. But is it selfless? Not really, because I feel better about myself when I help other people. So rather than creating this distinction between selfless and selfish, what we need is what I've come to see as an upward spiral of generosity, where I help myself, and through helping myself, I'm more likely to help others. And by helping others, I'm more likely to help myself, and on and on and on, which very much describes that mountaintop that you described. Let's all rise together.
Yes.
In this connection between what we call selfishness and selflessness. And I thought I coined a new word, but I then Googled it and found that other people have used it before me. Rather than selfishness and selflessness, we should talk about self-fullness.
Love that.
Which is the integration of the selfish gene and the selfless gene, so to speak.
I love that. This reminds me of Peter Emmons' work in gratitude. That definition of gratitude, or gratitude, has two components to it. One is the affirmation of goodness, which is I am thankful, but acknowledgement that it's outside you. So if you don't say I am a thankful person, so suddenly it can give you a high. No, because of you, I am feeling this. So it's I'm not because you can really become arrogant by like, I'm so self-effacing, you know, I'm so humble. No, you're, you know, you're like literally being selfish by calling yourself incredibly thankful and grateful. And you know, I'm a student of mindfulness. And one of the things that I'm noticing, I'm doing a mindfulness meditation teacher certification with Tara Brach and Jack Kornfield. It's going to take me 2 years, but it's so, I have had a meditation practice for 12 years and I entered this space and I have done a different kind of work, which is with Vedanta and then also with executive function. And then I arrive in this space. And one of the dangers that some contemplative research science talks about, that when you think about mindfulness, suddenly you become hyper-focused on self. So if without having the compassion piece, you are going to lose perspective because then you're going to be egocentric, right? What are your thoughts about that? People are now taking mindfulness so seriously that they're not bringing that it has to be useful to others, not self.
Yeah. You know, I don't think it's a coincidence that most of the Buddha statues are of him laughing heartfully.
Yes.
Because it's an indication, you know, stop taking yourself so seriously.
And you
know, what I often find in you know, I meditate daily as well. And what I often find in meditation classes and retreats is, you know, it's so somber and it's so serious. playfulness is very important. And I want to say just something about playfulness because it's a central, you know, every morning I have my reminders. Reminders are my core values that I remind myself every morning. And one of the core values for me that I remind myself every day is permission to be human. But another one is playfulness.
I love that.
And the reason I do I started it back in 2000, and I think it was 2008 or maybe 7.
Are you a prankster?
I'm not a prankster, but I
want to hear how you are playful. That's fabulous.
Yeah, let me share. So how I came to it was I got a manuscript in the mail, a very big manuscript from a Stuart Brown, and I didn't know him then. But Dr. Stuart Brown is the
play. Yes.
Yes. He wrote a book, a manuscript on play, and he said, you know, can you read it and maybe blurb it if you like it. Now, usually when I get books to read and blurb, I go through it, and then if I like it, I blurb. If I don't, I decline cordially. This book I couldn't put down. I read word for word, and at the end of it, I was completely taken and realizing just how important play is. And I called my best friend. Her name is Shirley. She's a child psychologist, and she's my go-to person whenever I have issues with relating to kids. And I said to her, Shirley, I just read this book. You have to read it. It's amazing. But it really got me thinking and I'm concerned. And she said, why are you concerned? And I said, well, David was 4 years old then. I said, you know, David is such a lovely kid and he's wonderful. And, but he's also so serious and he doesn't play enough. And now I realize how important play is. He doesn't play enough. And suddenly there is silence on the other side of the line. And I said, hello, Shirley, are you there? And she said, yeah, I'm here. And then a few seconds go by and she asks me this question. And she says, Tal, do you play enough?
Yes.
And, you know, it was one of those questions that that change your life. It was a rhetorical question. She knows me well. And, you know, I'm so serious and, you know, I'm, you know, in my head and cognitive and live the over-examined life.
Yes.
At that point I resolved and I said, first I want to do it for myself, but even more so for my children. And I started to play more, you know, being the change that I wanted to see in David. And we have a playful family. You know, and
playful
could be, you know, playing basketball together or, you know, making TikTok dances together. Please don't look me up. Or you know, being silly.
Silly, yes, so important.
And that's okay, and that's important. So being playful is a very important part of happiness, and it takes us out of, you know, this self-importance and, you know, very solipsistic existence.
You know, I think that's why I think you have such rave reviews with your students. I think to relate to young adults with incredible candor and honesty and yet challenge them head on, not be afraid of them, or motivate them when they have this generalized apathy about life. And I think you have a twinkle in your eyes. And even in your writing, I think there's a great play on things, you know, play on words, play on ideas. There's a tongue in cheek. I appreciate that deeply. As we end, I do want to know quickly, you are the happiness guru, and people are going to probably hate me for not taking all this time and talking about happiness, but I wanted to truly remove the barriers to happiness, because if they got rid of their perfectionism, they can actually arrive in the chambers of happiness. So you talk about these seven lessons, many lessons, but the seven broad lessons, which is you give your, I love that for the first one, which is give yourself permission to be human, which is exactly what you just said. Just don't take yourself so seriously that you need to be Einstein or die. You know, you don't need to invent a molecule. You can be fine. But you also talk about that many parts. What are a few of your favorite happiness recommendations for humble mere mortal like me?
Yeah. So, you know, the thing about these basics is that they are important for all of us. So people ask me, so Tal, what do you do now that, you know, we're in quarantine and going through a difficult time and experiencing, you know, a global level trauma, what do you do? And I say to them, I go back to the basics. You know, I do more of them, but I go back to the basics. For example, physical exercise. There's so much research showing that regular physical exercise has the same effect on our psychological well-being as our most powerful psychiatric medication. So exercising 3 times a week, you know, 30 minutes each time. It could be swimming or walking, or best of all, dancing, or soccer, whatever your favorite sport is, you know. So sports is important. Movement is important. Second, expressing gratitude. You know, the work by Emmons and McAuliffe, before that, brought to us by Oprah herself. Yes. So, you know, keeping a gratitude journal or going around the, you know, the dinner table and sharing things for which you're grateful. Writing a gratitude letter. These are all very powerful, simple, but powerful interventions. Keeping a journal in general, you know, writing about painful experiences, writing about what you're going through can help you make sense of your life. Number one predictor of happiness, relationships, quality time we spend with people we care about and who care about us. And again, remember, there are no perfect relationships. But there are intimate, meaningful, deep relationships, which are very important to cultivate. You know, you mentioned Sucheta, meditation. The research on meditation is literally and metaphorically mind-boggling. And it doesn't have to be, you know, 3 hours of, you know, lotus position silent meditation. It can be even, you know, 5 minutes focusing on the breath going in and out, or listening to your favorite music mindfully without distraction. So these are some of the elements, and I have to end with one more, which is not one of my big lessons, but it's something that I've just introduced recently into my life. So I came across Wim Hof. Wim Hof is best known as the Iceman.
Oh, yes, I know. Okay, I was thinking, where have I heard? Yes.
So, you know, the world record, you know, in terms of sitting the most longest amount of time in ice water, which is over 2 hours, which I think is
mind-boggling. Yes.
But even, you know, beyond the sensationalism of it, he has very simple techniques. One of them is a relatively straightforward pranayama technique. So, you know, I'm a big fan of pranayama, of playing with our breath. You know, it's such a powerful tool. But the second tool that he recommends, which I've also taken up, is cold showers.
And, yes.
And it turns out, and, you know, this is something that I've just discovered. And, you know, I was telling my wife this yesterday. I said, I can't believe that I haven't encountered it before. You know, I research happiness, and there is actually a lot of research on cold exposure, on cold showers, both for physical health as well as for psychological health. So this is
love it.
I must say, many of my students are cursing me now as they're taking a cold shower. But I say to them, it's for a good cause, happiness.
So I have to tell you two things about that. I love, love, love your recommendation. And thank you for weaving that. I'm looking forward to you kind of making emphatic case for it. So one, have you seen the recent documentary that has come on Netflix called My Octopus Teacher?
Beautiful. One of my favorite all-time movies.
Oh, my God. So he talks about how he acclimatized himself to so that his heart doesn't pound. He can actually become one with that ocean. And I just love that story. And second thing is, so each year as part of my spiritual journey, I take a resolution that helps me connect my mind and body together. So last year's resolution was 1 year of cold shower. So I cannot tell you this is like terrible, but I could not wait for that 1 year to be over. And I must say, I was very proud of myself for just cursing myself for taking a vow of that kind or a resolution, and then eventually not really paying attention. And then one time accidentally, we went to a rest. I mean, we were traveling somewhere, and the setting was off that, you know, that how you have red and whatever, or left and right. And it was just opposite. And accidentally, I got the barrage of hot water, which was kind of a treat, but then I felt like I was betraying myself. So I'm like, no, cold water. But that really gave me a great perspective. And I don't know if directly contributed to happiness or not, but it just taught me that I can develop patience, I can develop tolerance, and I can actually have a relationship of self-created adversity that can last longer than real adversity might.
Yes. No. So this is, I mean, a few issues. One issue is, so Wim Hof and generally people who recommend cold exposure don't say this is the only thing you should have. So, you know, I still enjoy and I love, you know, a warm or a hot shower. But at the end, you know, for 30 seconds or a minute, you know, go very cold. Or immerse yourself, you know, if you have a cold water source nearby, you know, immerse yourself for, you know, a minute. It doesn't have to be for a long time. So it's not about giving up pleasures. It's about adding a little bit of discomfort.
Yes.
Now, this discomfort is important because as I, you know, you go to the gym and you don't lift weights and there is no discomfort, you don't grow stronger. Modern life has become so comfortable that it's making us uncomfortable.
Yes.
Because, you know, we're always, you know, dressed up and, you know, when kids leave their house, parents are obsessed with them being, you know, we're overprotective, whether it's with our clothes, whether it's in terms of their struggles at school, you know, we're helicopter parents. No, let them struggle. We need to struggle as well. And it's through that struggle. And by the way, this has a lot to do, of course, with Sunia Luthar's research.
Yes.
On the underprivilege of privilege. We need to also let them struggle, and we need to struggle ourselves as well.
Well, I can talk to you for hours, and I do not mean to take up more time than I have. I really appreciate this amazing banter. Before I let you go, what are two your favorite book recommendations for our audience that have influenced you in some way or your work?
Yeah, so there are a few books that really influenced me over the years. The first one is Nathaniel Brandon's The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem. Nathaniel Brandon passed away a few years ago. He was a mentor, a teacher. I got to meet him after reading his book. It's a book that continues to be with me today. He talks there about self-acceptance. He talks there about responsibility. He talks there about integrity, about awareness, self-awareness, and so many of the components that today that I teach and try to live. So that's the first book, Six Pillars of Self-Esteem. The second one, which is also a book that that changed my life for the better, it's a book by Jeffrey Schwartz, who's a neuroscientist from UCLA. And Sucheta, if you can invite him for your podcast, you will thank me.
Really?
He is incredible. And his work, his book, which I recommend everyone, is called You Are Not Your Brain. And he was one of the first people to show, let alone talk about, neuroplasticity. Fascinating researcher, thinker, person. So that's the second book. And I know you asked for two, but I have to give another one.
Yes, please.
Which is Marva Collins was a school teacher in inner city.
I have read her. Yes.
And also passed away just a couple of years ago. A real role model to me. I'm also dedicating my new book to
her. Did you know her personally?
I did get to meet her.
Wow.
It was maybe the highlight of my life, but certainly one of the highlights. And she wrote a book called The Marva Collins Way, which is essentially an autobiography. When I read that book, that's when I decided that my calling in life was to be a teacher.
Oh, wow. I use her as an ideal model teacher in my workshops when I talk to educators, and I use her story of how she inspired children to the students when I work with. I love Marva Collins' story. And these are amazing. I saw that you recommend your 6 pillars of self-esteem to your students as a required reading. That is one book that I have not read, but a Jeffrey Schwartz book I have read. I'm feeling I'm halfway there. So you're giving me more work to do. I really appreciate you being on this podcast. Listeners, please, I'm going to add a lot of show notes for Tal's website, his courses. There's one coming up. Very spoon, or maybe started already. No, it's coming up.
There's always one that started and one that's coming up.
Oh, okay, great. And I highly recommend, I'm actually waiting for your masterclass, by the way. I hope masterclass people have contacted you. But thank you for tuning in today on Full Prefrontal, Exposing the Mysteries of Executive Function. Once again, if you love what you're listening to, please share the wealth and help us connect with more people. And stay strong, be bold, and take good decisions so that your frontal lobes guide you to become a happier, more than you already are. Thank you, Tal, for being here with me today.
Thank you, Sujet.
Thank you for listening to Full Prefrontal, Exposing the Mysteries of Executive Function. To contact your host, Sucheta Kamath, and learn more about her work on improving executive function, visit her website at exqinfiniteknowhow.com. That's www.exqinfiniteknowhow.com. Tune in next week for another informative episode of Full Prefrontal, hosted by the founder of EXQ, Sucheta Kamath.